Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, July 22, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call. Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on today's circuit split on the federal health care exchange subsidies. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Also, please note that today's call is open to the press. Today, we welcome two experts to talk about the topic. The first is Professor Jonathan Adler, who is a professor at Case Western University School of Law. And the second is Professor Nicholas Bagley, who is an assistant professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School. More complete bios of our speakers were provided to a notice of the call, so I'll stop there and reserve more time for their presentations and discussion, followed by your question. And without any further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Professor Jonathan Adler. Professor Adler, the floor is yours.
Well, great. Thank you. And it's a pleasure to be on the call today and to have the opportunity to discuss this case again with Nick. Some of you may have been on the call we did earlier this year, previewing this case and debating the merits. And so it's good to be able to do that again. Today, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit issued an opinion in Halbig versus Burwell, a challenge to a regulation issued by the Internal Revenue Service purporting to authorize tax credits and cost-sharing subsidies for the purchase of qualifying health insurance in health insurance exchanges that were established by the federal government in those states that did not create their own. The court held 2-1 that this regulation exceeded the scope of the agency's authority under the Affordable Care Act and was contrary to the plain language of the statute. Judge Griffith wrote the majority opinion. He was joined by Senior Judge Randolph, who also wrote a very brief concurrence, and Senior Judge Edwards dissented. Also today, coincidentally, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit issued its opinion in a companion case called King versus Burwell, raising the same issue. The court there ruled 3-0 in favor of the government. I'm going to mostly focus my remarks on the Halbig decision. I'll say just a little bit about the King decision. I have not had as much time to digest that. But both, I think what the court did in both cases is certainly interesting as we look at the issue. So the underlying issue here is what the Affordable Care Act authorizes in terms of tax credits and cost-sharing subsidies for the purchase of qualifying insurance plans in health insurance exchanges. The bill that was enacted, which was based on the Senate bill, which relied very heavily on state participation to meet the Act's various goals, encouraged states to create their own health insurance exchanges, and provided that if states don't create their own exchanges, the federal government would step in and create the exchange in the state's place. The difficulty arises because in the portion of the law that talks about the subsidies and tax credits that individuals can receive when purchasing health insurance, it says that the plans for which tax credits are available are those purchased on an exchange established by a state under Section 1311 of the Act. And Section 1311 of the Act is the provision that tells states to create exchanges. This is important because 36 states did not create their own exchanges. That is to say, the exchanges in 36 states were not established by the state. And so if this is a limitation on the availability of tax credits, then tax credits and cost-sharing subsidies are not available in those states. The IRS, in response to the fact that many states were refusing to create their own exchanges, issued a regulation that said that it would make tax credits available in exchanges without regard for whether or not they were created by a state or by the federal government. This regulation is what was challenged in these cases. The IRS, as the court notes, really did not offer much justification, much legal justification for this rule when it first issued it, beyond noting that there was some controversy over whether it had this authority and saying that in its view, its rule was consistent with the text of the Act. The D.C. Circuit today held that the IRS rule is not consistent with the text of the Act. And for those that listened to the oral argument, the nub of the opinion, or the central the central finding of the court in reaching this opinion, was not a surprise. At the end of the day, the court concluded that the phrase established by the state was really not open to interpretation. Established by the state is not established by the federal government. It is established by the state, and the federal government had not been able to offer an explanation for what that language does or what purpose it serves in the statute if it does not limit the exchanges in which tax credits can be available, and that the federal government was not able to point to enough evidence in either in other portions of the statute or in legislative history to overcome the plain text of the statute. The court, and I posted a couple brief excerpts from the opinion on the Volokh conspiracy blog that's hosted by the Washington Post, where the Judge Griffith outlines his approach. And he basically says, you know, we start with the text of the statute. We have this relatively plain language exchange established by the state that is clear. We look at the broader context in which it appears. There is nothing in the statute that contradicts this language, nothing in the statute that is inoperative or impossible to reconcile if we interpret this language as it is plain or as is plainly written. And there's nothing in legislative history or elsewhere that would justify departing from the plain meaning of this language. In some respects, this is similar to the first part of what the Supreme Court's opinion in the Utility Air Resources Group, a greenhouse gas case, where the court said there may be other parts of the statute that are ambiguous, but a numerical limit on emissions is a clear numerical limit. The agency can't just wave that away. Similarly, here the D.C. Circuit said that the phrase established by the state has to mean something, and there's no reason for concluding it means something other than established by the state. It is worth noting that the district court here had ruled in favor of the government and had ruled on Chevron Step 1 grounds. That is to say, the district court had held that the Affordable Care Act language was not ambiguous either, and that it clearly authorized tax credits in exchanges established by the federal government. The majority in the D.C. Circuit rejected that judgment today. It's worth noting that the Fourth Circuit opinion in King versus Burwell, while siding with the government, likewise rejected the rationale that the district court in the District of Columbia had reached. That is, the majority or the court in King concluded that the government would prevail because the Fourth Circuit found the relevant language sufficiently ambiguous to allow for the government to substitute its own reasonable interpretation of that language under Step 2 of Chevron. And I think, while I disagree with that conclusion, I think that's a more defensible position than the one that had been adopted by the district court in the District of Columbia. One other thing I'll just say briefly about the opinion. The opinion also gets into some threshold jurisdictional questions that the federal government has raised in all of the cases challenging the tax credit rule. The federal government had argued the plaintiffs lacked standing, and then also argued that the court should not hear the case because there was an adequate remedy in the form of a tax reimbursement suit or tax refund suit that could be filed. The D.C. Circuit made relatively quick work of those arguments. I think it was pretty clear the plaintiffs had standing because of the way the tax credits interact with other portions of the statute. In particular, the tax credits both trigger the penalties for the employer mandate and also increase exposure for many individuals to the individual mandate penalty, either of those easily enough to establish standing. And the court likewise held that a tax refund suit would not be an adequate remedy. That's a quick summary of the opinion. I'll turn it over to Nick, who I know is going to say a little bit about what comes next and may offer some additional thoughts about what the courts did today.
So thank you again for including me in this call. I very much appreciate it. Jonathan's offered a really good, straight, incisive recap of what happened in Halbig. I wanted to do two things. First, I want to just dispel a myth that I think is circulating about the government's position in this case and about Judge Edwards' dissent in the case, which is that somehow the government is attempting to say, look, we understand the statute says X, but we just ignore the statute and we go with what we divine to be its purpose, which is to extend health insurance coverage to people across the United States. That's not, in fact, accurate. Judge Edwards's dissent and the Fourth Circuit opinion in King are both highly textual decisions. What we have here is a clash, not between interpreters who either sort of valorize the text or disregard it, but between interpreters who take a more or less solicitous view of the context in which that text ought to be understood. So the challengers in the case and that brought Halbig and that brought King have focused intently on the portion of the Internal Revenue Code that governs the calculation of tax credits. And they say by using the phrase established by the state, Congress meant to deprive individuals who are purchasing health plans on federally established exchanges of tax credits that would otherwise be available to them. Judge Edwards in the Fourth Circuit said, look, we understand the established by the state language is there, and we think in context, what Congress meant is, yeah, usually when a state establishes exchange, and Congress anticipated that most states would establish their own exchanges, this is how you go about calculating the tax credits. But it's abundantly clear from lots of portions of the ACA itself, of the greater text, that Congress didn't mean to withdraw tax credits from those who purchased health plans on federally established exchanges. Instead, the context makes it abundantly clear that what Congress meant was for HHS to step into the shoes of the states when HHS moved to establish exchanges on the state's behalf. And it's that text, that greater context, that Judge Edwards in the Fourth Circuit turned to in offering a deeply textual interpretation of the statute. I just don't want to have the impression that there's some kind of, you know, one side ignores the text and the other side pays it heed. The question is, what do you do with the text that we have, and how do we figure out what Congress meant by the words that it selected? Do we focus narrowly on a particular snippet, or do we focus more broadly on the statute as a whole? The second point I want to make very briefly is what happens next? As it stands, the mandate in this case doesn't issue for at least 52 days. When I say the mandate issues, it means that the judgment doesn't have legal force for 52 days. Why 52 days? Well, the government has 45 days in which it can petition for rehearing en banc, which is to say it can ask the full D.C. Circuit to rehear the case. Likewise, in King against Burwell, the challengers have 45 days to ask the Fourth Circuit to rehear the case. If neither side moved for en banc rehearing, the mandate would issue a week later. In all likelihood, the government will seek en banc rehearing in the Halbig case. When it does so, the mandate will be stayed, meaning that the judgment will lack any kind of legal effect, and the D.C. Circuit will then consider whether to grant the petition for rehearing en banc. Given the composition of the D.C. Circuit, which tilts 7-4 in terms of active judges, Democrat-appointed to Republican-appointed, there is a reasonably good chance that the D.C. Circuit will vote to rehear the case en banc. And indeed, in the very last paragraph of Judge Edwards' opinion in Halbig, he refers to the majority's, quote, proposed judgment, which suggests that he believes that the case is quite likely to be reheard en banc, and if it is reheard, to be superseded by a decision upholding the IRS's tax credit rule along the lines of the theory that he espoused in dissent. At the Fourth Circuit, the odds of getting en banc review are somewhat slimmer. There was no dissent from the decision upholding the IRS rule, and that court leans pretty heavily democratically appointed at this point. Not to say that anybody is voting simply because they like the Affordable Care Act or dislike the Affordable Care Act, but the sort of style of statutory interpretation that Judge Griffith evinced in Halbig against Burwell is one that is more likely to appeal to somebody who leans sort of ideologically to the right. The more sort of relaxed, I guess you could put it, mode of statutory construction appeals more to those who lean from the left. I don't think that the Fourth Circuit is likely to rehear the case because so many left-leaning judges sit on it. As a result, I think the very likely outcome once the D.C. Circuit rehears the case is that we won't, in fact, have split decisions from the D.C. Circuit and the Fourth Circuit. In all likelihood, what we'll have are decisions that point in the same direction. And at that point, the question is whether the Supreme Court will grant the case, notwithstanding the absence of a split, in order to offer its views about the correct outcome, or whether it will stay its hand. And I think it's just too early to know exactly what the Supreme Court in that context would choose to do. I should say, though, as I'm making these predictions, you never know. It's quite possible that the D.C. Circuit will decline to hear the case en banc. It's quite possible that the Fourth Circuit will choose to rehear it en banc. But my best guess is that by the time this is all said and done, at the circuit court level, we'll have a couple of decisions that lean that vote to uphold the IRS's rule. And that's all I've got.
Professor Adler, do you want to offer any further thoughts before we go to questions?
Yeah, let me just say a couple things really quickly. First, I'd like to emphatically underline the point that Nick made about understanding how different judges approach this case. There is an unfortunate tendency to reduce judges and their opinions to the ideology or party of the president that appointed them. And I think Nick is absolutely right that the underlying methods of interpretation are a better predictor of how judges will respond or approach this sort of question than who appointed them. It so happens that Republican-appointed judges tend to be what I would call more textualist, and Nick might not like that characterization, and those appointed by Democratic presidents tend to be more, shall we say, purpose-oriented or more purposivist in their interpretation of statutes. If one thinks, for example, the way Justice Scalia interprets a statute versus the way Justice Breyer interprets a statute, we see clear methodological differences that are distinct from whatever we assume are those justices' ideological preferences. And I do think that those interpretive differences actually explain the different approaches. I think it's fair to say that judges on the Fourth Circuit and that Judge Edwards are more concerned about whether or not the result of interpreting the statute as a whole works in a way that they think makes sense or that they think the drafters wanted it to work. I think that the majority in Halbig is more interested in parsing the specific language word for word. That is to say, Judge Griffith wants established by the state to mean established by the state in some meaningful way. Judge Edwards thinks that that phrase does not need to have the plain meaning that the words on their own would seem to suggest. Another comment I would make is on banc, whether this case goes on banc, the administration has said that they are going to file a petition for en banc review in the D.C. Circuit. It's not clear to me this case is actually en banc worthy. It is well understood that it takes more for a case to be en banc worthy. It is not enough that some or even a majority of the judges think it is wrong. Mm-hmm. It actually must raise other sorts of issues for it to be en banc worthy. And I think this case is a close case. So while if I had to bet, I would say en banc review is more likely than not, I don't think it's as sure a thing as some commentators have suggested. For those that are interested, there's a very good opinion by Judge Jeff Sutton from a case, Mitz versus Bagley, I assume that's no relation, from December of 2010, where Judge Sutton walked through why a case being wrong is not enough for him to vote for en banc review. And I think there are many judges that hold to that view. And so we'll certainly have to see how the D.C. Circuit responds to that.
All right. Well, if both of our experts are ready, we can go ahead and move to questions from the audience. And before we do that, I do want to make an announcement. For those of you who were not able to get on the call initially, we did add more capacity, and hopefully most of the waiting room has been let in. But for those of you who missed the first portion of the call, we will try to post this as a podcast on our website as quickly as possible, hopefully tomorrow morning. And so for whatever you missed, you can catch the beginning of it online. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. And while we're waiting for the questions to come on, if I could take the moderator's prerogative and ask one question of our experts. Just curious what your thoughts are on Professor Lawrence Tribe's comments that he wouldn't bet the family farm on this surviving, and his thinking as to how Chief Justice John Roberts would address this question.
I think that there is a tendency sometimes to write opinions or make comments suggesting what one or more justices will do that is as much an effort to encourage particular conduct by justices as it is an actual prediction. But I think that if this case goes to the Supreme Court, It will be a challenging case for many of the justices. I think it raises some similar issues to the greenhouse gas case that the court heard earlier this year. And I think it will be a close case. I mean, I think that some justices' natural approach to interpreting statutes would lead them to side with the majority in Halbig, and there are some other justices whose traditional approach to statutory interpretation would lead them to side with the government. And, you know, what Chief Justice Roberts would do, you know, I think we all have learned that it's somewhat perilous to try and predict his individual votes.
I would only agree with Jonathan on as to everything that he said there. By no means, you know, all of the justices are aware that statutory construction doesn't take place in a vacuum, that it's not merely about even just looking at the phrase established by the state under 1311, that it's a question that goes to the full context of the statute and that they're going to have to investigate it and come to their own judgment about how the statute ought to be construed to make sense of it as a whole. I think this decision, it's safe to say that this decision justifies Tribe's warning in the following sense. It would have been foolish to bet the farm that the D.C. Circuit would have upheld it. But I wouldn't encourage any of you to mortgage your homesteads to bet against, you know, to bet that the IRS rule will be upheld. But I don't know that it's easy for us to be able to, it's very difficult to make predictions about what the Supreme Court might eventually do.
All right. Well, it looks like we had five questions jump on the line, so we will get right to them.
Good afternoon. This is Dave Ingram. I'm a reporter at Reuters. I was interested in Professor Bagley's, I think it was Professor Bagley's comments about how this might play out with an en banc rehearing and possible cert petition. One question I had is whether the best route for the plaintiffs would be to just go ahead and file a cert petition right now from the Fourth Circuit ruling, if that is if that's allowed.
It certainly is allowed. Whether they'll choose to do it depends on a whole host of strategic considerations. I'm not party to the conversations that the litigants are having, so I can't speak to any of that. What I can tell you is that, in general, the Supreme Court looks more favorably on cert petitions if the litigants have dotted their I's and crossed their T's, and seeking en banc reconsideration is sometimes a way of demonstrating to the court that you've done everything you can to seek to get relief before you ask them to intervene or intercede, rather. I can also say that they may be, the litigants on both sides, the government and the challengers, are going to be looking at how the King decision interacts with the timing of any kind of en banc review should it occur in the Halbig case. It is quite possible that the challengers in King will choose to pretermit en banc reconsideration in the hope that the court takes King. But it's very hard to know without sort of getting in the heads of the particular lawyers and their clients.
All right, we'll go ahead and move right to the next question. We've got one, two, three, four callers on the line, and then our lines will be open.
This is Kent Hoover from American City Business Journals. If the D.C. Circuit declines to rehear it en banc, does that make it more likely that the Supreme Court will agree to hear the case, since there will be two conflicting district court appeals court rulings?
Yes. I think with the current court in particular, the best way to get a case before the court is a circuit split. I mean, that's always been true to some extent, but the current court seems less eager to reach out and accept cases where there's not a circuit split than some prior courts have been. So that would certainly maximize the likelihood of Supreme Court review. And I would add, if I worked for the administration, or I was strategizing about how to keep the case from reaching the Supreme Court, my strategy would certainly be to try and eliminate the circuit split, and that would be one reason for seeking en banc review.
Yeah, I would only add that even if there were not a circuit split, if there were a significant and critical federal rule that were invalidated by a circuit court of appeals and there was significant debate about whether or not that invalidation was legally appropriate, that would by itself be a pretty strong case in favor of Supreme Court review, given that there would also, on your sort of hypothesis, under your hypothesis that there'd be a split, I think it would be almost a certainty.
All right. Well, let's. We've got three questions pending. Let's move right to the next one.
Hi, Larry Callahan. My question has been answered, so you might as well move on rather than me just not responding. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Callahan.
Hey there. William Bateman from the University of Tennessee College of Law. My question is, does the Fourth Circuit and the D.C. Circuit cases, were they brought on the exact same grounds, really the same issues, or in either way, are the cases in any way distinguishable from each other? And does the D.C. Circuit, does that one, because they deal more with administrative law, does it bear more weight with this kind of decision, or because they're both Court of Appeals decisions, are they sort of equal?
The cases were litigated by the same attorneys, Mike Carvin and his team at Jones Day, represented the plaintiffs in both cases, and are fairly parallel. I mean, I don't think there are many differences that are meaningful in terms of the legal issues in the two cases. There are two other cases pending in district court, one in Oklahoma, one in Indiana. Given the identities of the plaintiffs in those cases, there are some other issues there. So, for example, the case in Oklahoma was brought by the state attorney general, Scott Pruitt, on behalf of the state. And so because there's a state litigant, that does raise some slightly different wrinkles, particularly in with regard to some of the jurisdictional questions. That was the first part. The second part was I'm now blanking on the second
does
part.
Does the D.C. question. Circuit's decision carry more weight?
Oh, well, of course, because it's the one that agrees with me. No, you know, I think, you know, as a legal matter, no. The D.C. Circuit is often referred to as, you know, the second highest court in the land, or is pointed to as being where a higher percentage of Supreme Court justices have come from in recent years, at least, than other circuits, and certainly deals with complex regulatory statutes more often. But I don't think that there's no legal difference, and it's not clear that the Supreme Court would necessarily care more about which court reached which conclusion. I think they're more concerned about the reasoning and their own view of the merits.
Yeah, I'll second that. The Supreme Court, in my experience, is not terribly concerned with what the lower courts have had to say on a particular issue. They are asked to make up their minds in hard cases and will do so based on their best sense of what the law is. And to the extent that lower court opinions shed some light on that, that can be helpful. But only helpful.
All right. Well, we have two questions currently pending, and our lines will be open. So, again, if you'd like to ask a question of either of our experts, press star and then the pound key. Star and then the pound key.
Hi, my name is Dick Stoll, and I do a lot of administrative law judicial review, but mostly from the EPA perspective, and I'm kind of confused because I'm used to having exclusive jurisdiction in the D.C. Circuit, and so when the D.C. Circuit does something, unless it goes up, you know what the effect is. For either professor or both, I'm really confused now. I wasn't even aware of this Fourth Circuit litigation. I thought everything was in the D.C. Circuit. So they both come down today. What if the D.C. Circuit does not grant en banc? So what happens if the D.C. Circuit mandate issues and the Fourth Circuit mandate issues? Where are we? I'm really confused on that point.
I can take a stab at this, Jonathan.
Sure.
The answer is it's complicated. At the very last stage prior to the oral argument in the Helbig case, the federal government sent in a letter to the court suggesting that any decision that the court issued ought to be confined to the litigants that have brought the case, and that the IRS rule ought not be invalidated on a nationwide basis. In response, the challengers offered a very forceful rejection of that position and said that in the D.C. Circuit, the typical remedy when there's a facial challenge to an agency rule is to invalidate the rule and set it aside on a nationwide basis. The reason that this is complicated, and it goes to sort of very deep waters of administrative law, is that typically when a particular circuit court issues its decision, that decision holds only in the jurisdiction that the circuit court has, only in the circuit court's geographic area. The presence of the possibility of D.C. Circuit review kind of screws that up a little bit, because the D.C. Circuit is thought to have a special sort of more national approach towards many of these issues. What the question in practice will boil down to: what will the government do in response to the D.C. Circuit's decision, should it issue, should the mandate ever come out? And it's not at all clear to me what they would choose to do, whether they would choose to honor that decision as a nationwide invalidation of the rule, which is what the challengers would refer, or whether they would simply aver that the court's judgment extended only to the plaintiffs and risk getting hauled by the challengers in front of the court and told that they were flouting the court's judgment. I think it's too early to know exactly how that'll all play out, and in all likelihood, given what I think is a pretty likely chance that this case will go en banc, none of this will end up mattering very much. But suffice it to say that it's complicated.
Yeah, I would largely agree with that. I think, you know, we are familiar with instances where the reverse happens, where one of the regional circuits invalidates a regulation that was not invalidated elsewhere. In the environmental context, that was the case with the migratory bird interpretation of the EPA and Corps regulations governing the scope of navigable waters. For a period of time, the Fourth Circuit had struck that down on procedural grounds, so the federal government could not rely upon that interpretation within the Fourth Circuit while it continued to rely upon it elsewhere. In this case, if for some reason the D.C. Circuit does not grant en banc review, I would think that it would be inconceivable to me that we don't get a cert petition from the administration, and I would think it's very unlikely that the D.C. Circuit would not stay the mandate until the resolution of the cert petition and proceedings before the Supreme Court. So I think it's very unlikely that we actually have to confront these questions, which, as Nick said, are difficult, and that we fortunately don't have to confront too often, although there is a relatively recent D.C. Circuit case on point where the court was very critical of an agency for continuing to enforce a regulation in part of the country that had been invalidated in another circuit. And in that particular case, the opinion, which I believe was written by Judge Edwards, if I recall correctly,
it was
noted that it turned on the
language
factor
of an EPA regulation.
Right. In that particular case, the agency had itself represented that this was a rule that needed to be nationally consistent. And so it's not clear if that would necessarily apply here. But it is interesting that we did just get an opinion that touches slightly on these questions.
All right. Well, we've got about 10 minutes left on the call and 4 questions to get to, so we'll try to get to all of them.
John Roll at Constitution.org. It seems that this decision is actually raising ambiguities that almost cry for appellate review, simply to clarify the decision itself, if nothing else. But to what extent is the administrative ruling, consistent with the statute? And to what extent may the statute have maybe textually or intentionally defective in that regard, at least as far as the intent of the lawmakers? And to what extent has anyone done at least a back of the envelope estimation of the fiscal impact on the program of this decision if applied nationwide?
Well, just a couple things. I'm sure Nick has thoughts on this as well. First, this decision, if applied nationwide, means that tax credits and cost-sharing subsidies are not available in 36 states unless and until those states decide to establish their own exchanges. And it's certainly possible that some states would choose to do so if the D.C. Circuit decision ends up being the law of the land and the final resolution of this question. In terms of this statute itself, and we didn't get into this on this call, although Nick and I have discussed this before, the Affordable Care Act in some respects creates a perfect storm for this type of litigation because of the way it was enacted. It did not go through the normal House bill, Senate bill, conference report, legislative history process that a bill normally goes through. That process was underway and then got short-circuited when Senator Scott Brown was elected to replace Ted Kennedy, depriving the Democrats of the votes they needed to pass a conference bill through the Senate. And so the bill never went through the normal process of dotting every I and crossing every T that large bills like this tend to go through. It also did not represent what many people really wanted as the final bill. And so that just means that it's we're doing all of our normal work in terms of statutory interpretation and implementation in the context of what was kind of a rough draft. And that raises lots of interesting questions about how that should, if at all, alter our normal approaches to interpretation and how, if at all, it should alter our view of the nature of agency authority. And those questions are particularly hard to answer here because we don't have many other equivalent examples, and we all know that the way we answer these questions has very real effects on specific rules proposed under this statute. So, you know, we don't have the veil of ignorance that we can sometimes hide behind in terms of trying to answer these broader theoretical questions about how the nature of a law's passage should affect the way we interpret and implement it.
Yeah. I would add just, you know, 36 states, 34 states, it depends on who you ask and who's doing the counting, but, you know, there are tens of millions of people who have access to tax credits today who would lose tax credits. So the fiscal impact would be huge and the impact on families would be enormous. It's not altogether predictable about how this would play out politically. As Jonathan said, some states may choose to establish their own exchanges. After all, it's more or less a, you know, stroke of the pen and then some technical work, although not necessarily easy technical work. But state voters might reasonably say, look, you know, people in California and Texas are getting tax credits. Why are you here in Michigan, for example, refusing to establish an exchange, which is really not that big of a deal to begin with? It's just a way for people to buy health insurance, the way to organize different health plans so that it's easy to see how much they cost and what their trade-offs are. You know, it's quite possible that the decision will have a fairly negligible effect if the states as a group move to establish their own exchanges. That said, you know, the politics around the Affordable Care Act are combustible and they are white hot, and it's possible that lots of states will decline to do so. I wish I could tell you how I knew this was going to play out. I just don't. What I can say is that it's a big sort of wrench in the works, at least for the moment. In terms of Jonathan's point that this was really a rough draft, he's absolutely right about that. All statutes, to some extent or another, all statutes, period, are the product of a very human institution, which is to say Congress. And so one question that interpreters have to confront is what do you do with a human product that inevitably is going to contain flaws? Judge Griffith's view is that, you know, the flaws are there, but there's not much we can't properly fix them, and we just, you know, do what the statute tells us to do, and we don't worry too much if the consequences are not very likely to be what Congress had in mind. The Judge Edwardses of the world and the Fourth Circuits of the world would say, you know, look, these are human documents. There is some sloppy language, and what we try to do is make sense of the statute as a whole and try to give all of its provisions, including those that might have been drafted in a little haste and not all that carefully, giving them the most sensible construction in light of the statute as a whole. There are competing ways of understanding the way we ought to go about construing statutes. And as Jonathan says, it's sort of a perfect storm for testing our intuitions about what the proper approach ought to be.
All right. Well, we've got about 5 minutes left on the call and multiple questions, so we'll try to get to as many as possible before we have to end.
Hi, this is Kurt Levy at the Committee for Justice. By the way, before I get to my question, I noticed Josh Earnest dismissed today's decision, saying, and I'm totally paraphrasing here, that it was of intellectual interest, but little else. So I think that might tell us what will happen if the mandate does issue. Couple of quick questions. One is, both of you are talking about this as a mistake in the statute. And certainly people have argued that it wasn't a mistake, that it was a way to try to get states to create their own exchanges. So question number one is, do you disagree with that argument? And then question number two, is there some way for the Supreme Court to split the baby on this? I don't know. That's why I'm asking. But, you know, maybe allow the employer mandate to survive in the states with the federal exchanges. And I ask because, you know, we saw at the end of the of this last Supreme Court term, a lot of those split the baby decisions, and you know, whether there's a way to split the baby might very well determine which way you know, Roberts or Kennedy goes.
I can do those quickly. The first is, I don't really see a way to split the baby here. You know, the split the baby approach is the Fourth Circuit's approach, which says the statute is ambiguous and we defer to the agency. And if that's not your, if you think that the statute is clear and that the IRS has it wrong, I think the rule has to go down. And then, you know, the split the baby approach leads to divergent outcomes that are pretty dramatic. I don't know of another way to split the baby here. In terms of the first point about whether or not the statute was intended to encourage or induce states to establish their own exchanges, the idea there is that withdrawing tax credits to those who purchased health plans on federally facilitated exchanges operated as a kind of threat, that you don't have to establish your own exchanges, states, but if you don't, your citizens are going to lose out. And if that was what Congress wanted, it's an unusual kind of threat, because for threats to work, they have to be communicated. In other words, the people on the receiving end of the threat have to understand the threat. They have to get it. And the states at the time that they were electing to establish their own exchanges didn't get it. And in fact, this is not a theory that had widespread currency until really today, except in sort of rarefied legal circles. So if in fact that's what Congress wanted, it's, I think, quite telling that nobody told the states. So I think as a matter of trying to reconstruct what Congress really meant, I think the position that they really meant to use this as coercive means to get states to establish their own exchanges is adventurous, and I think just simply not does not reflect the historical record. There's a more nuanced version of that argument, which is that Congress could, a reasonable Congress could have used these as threats, and we don't ask about what Congress really meant when its statute is clear, given that what it chose to do in the text of the statute is, you know, reasonable, even if that's not the world we live in. But I have a harder time with the historical claim that this was intended to be a threat.
Hey, let me, I agree with Nick on the first point he made on the intent of the statute. I think we have to remember what we mean by saying intent is, was the language put in there, and did it mean something or mean what it says, and did the author of that language intend it? We're not asking, if you polled every member of Congress, would they say this is what the statute we wanted? In fact, we know if we had polled every member of Congress at the time, the bill that passed is not the bill they wanted. But in this case, we know that the primary author of this bill, Senator Baucus, had used this almost exact same mechanism in other healthcare bills. We know that other draft legislation did condition tax credits and or subsidies on state cooperation or implementation of various aspects of the law. So this was something that the primary author of the Senate bill had done before. It's something that other drafts of healthcare reform did in various ways. It's something that Congress has done in many contexts. In terms of, did it have to be
But when it did it in other contexts, it did it quite clearly. I mean,
Yes and no. I don't think that's accurate. I mean, if we look at the oral argument about the Medicaid expansion, there was relatively little legislative history about the Medicaid expansion. And the language of the statute is actually less clear, because one had to go to the Medicaid language of the Affordable Care Act and then cross-reference stuff that was already in the U.S. Code. If states were not on notice here, they weren't on notice because of the IRS rule. The IRS, when it first proposed its rule, the issue was raised that what it was proposing to do was contrary to the text. The IRS acknowledged that was a problem. And what the IRS said to states was, we're going to treat all exchanges the same. And did states rely upon that? I assume most states did. It would have been sensible to rely upon that because the federal agency was telling them that, that it would not make a difference. And so that many states then relied upon that, I don't think tells us very much about what would have happened had they not relied upon that. But the question of intent, this is something that Congress has done before. It's something it's done before in the healthcare context. It's something that we know Congress considered in the context of healthcare reform by looking at other draft pieces of legislation. And we also know that the way that the Supreme Court has looked at similar language in cases like New York versus United States is interpreted similar language as existence of incentives. In New York, the court said when it finds a command to a state that states shall, there are two choices. It is either an unconstitutional nullity because it's an unconstitutional commandeering of the states, or if the statute provides some sort of alternative or can be read that way, the shall can instead be read as an incentive. And for that to work, there has to be something in the statute that is a consequence of the state's decision. In this case, there are multiple things that are a consequence of the state's decision. Startup funds, the maintenance of effort requirements for, or maintenance of eligibility requirements relating to Medicaid, and the availability of tax credits and subsidies. And the last point in terms of what Congress expected, Congress did not make available any money for the creation of federal exchanges, and CBO did not assume a single dollar would get spent creating federal exchanges. The assumption was that every state would willingly create its own exchange. If there was a mistake, the mistake was making that assumption, and perhaps a second mistake was rushing through a bill that really was not what its supporters wanted. Those may have been mistakes. I don't think that we can say the language of the statute is a mistake in that it clearly says what it clearly says, and I know Nick and I all disagree on that point, but I think that's the right way to read it.
All right. Well, we have run actually over our allotted time, so I want to start off by thanking both of our experts on behalf of the Federalist Society for joining us today. Thank you to our audience, as well as the press that joined us. We welcome your feedback anytime by email to info@fedsoc.org. Be sure to check out our new and improved website at the same web address, and continue to join us on these courthouse steps and other Teleform conference calls. So until next time, thank you. And remember that if you missed the beginning of the call, check back tomorrow at our website for the podcast of this call that you can listen to anytime. And actually, I've been informed that it will be available and up later this afternoon. So keep checking back, and we appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very much, and thanks, Nick, for doing it.
Thanks, Jonathan. Same to you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.